The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record Koan Collection, Case 100. Pa Ling's blown hair sword, the pointer. All summer, I've been verbosely making up complications and almost entangled and tripped up all the students in the land. But when the diamond sword cuts directly, I first realize my hundredfold incompetence. But tell me, what is the diamond sword like? Open your eyes and I'll reveal the sword point for you to see. The main case. A student asked Master Pa Ling, what is the blown hair sword? Pa Ling said, each branch of coral supports the moon. The poem. When it is necessary to even the uneven, even the great adept seems inept. Sometimes on the finger, sometimes in the palm. Leaning against the sky, it shines on the snow. Even a great smith cannot hone it. Even a master craftsman wouldn't finish polishing it. It is exceptional, unique. Each branch of coral supports the moon. So, good morning, everyone. Good morning. This weekend, we've been having an introduction to Zen practice with folks at home. So some of you who are joining us this morning have been with us this weekend, since Friday evening. And the koan is, meditation in Buddhism is a carefully honed art. And considering that for the great length of the Buddhist tradition, how important meditation has been since the beginning with the Buddha, and then in many, not all, but in many of the schools of Buddhism, ours being one, in which meditation was a primary practice. And given that throughout the ages, all Buddhist masters have been concerned, and practitioners have been concerned with what are the most effective, skillful means to liberate ourselves? What are those practices? And how do we engage in those practices? Meditation is that such a practice, and it has no fixed rule. It is not ambiguous. It's always, in a sense, very clear. It's not always clear to the student or the practitioner, but the practice itself from within the tradition, in its context of teachings, is very clear. And yet, there are many forms of meditation. They all have certain things in common because they're all based in the essential teachings of Buddhism and the intention for that meditation practice to bring one to an open-hearted compassion, to a calming of the mind, and to the insight that cuts through all of our attachments and delusions and forms of entanglement that lead us to create suffering for ourselves and others. And so the koan is one of those forms of practice. They are generally questions. Sometimes they're taken from sutras. In this case, it's a question that a student brought to a teacher. That's common. They're often dialogues. And the koan is like a world that the student enters into. And oftentimes it seems opaque. It seems like there's got to be more here. This is not enough. And the intention or the effort of the student is not to underestimate the koan or themselves. Because if they do, then they will start to become conceptual and intellectual. They'll start to fill in the gaps with what they know, with what they expect, with what they think should be there. And so there's a kind of austerity, you might say, with the practice of the koan, right? A renunciation of letting it be just this. And then the student takes that up as a as an object of their meditation and enters into that world that the koan presents them with utterly. And in order to do that, they have to practice through and free themselves of whatever entanglements might be arising as they're practicing the koan. They have to let go of the self, the sense of self, and everything that comes with that, which is pretty much everything, and get to that place of nakedness, of spiritual poverty, where there is nothing else. And this is, koan is an example of how much of the teachings in Zen bring in images, metaphors, poetic phrases. Poetry is very important in the Zen tradition. It was important in China when Zen Chan was coming into being, but it lends itself to the language of the Dharma because by its nature, it's not linear. It's not base and conceptual, and it invites us in. It doesn't explain everything. It demands that we really enter in and leap free. And so here, this question, what is the blown hair sword? This blown hair sword was something that was familiar to these students. It was a sword that is so sharp that a hair just being blown against it cuts it in two. That's how sharp it is. That's pretty sharp. And this sword is a sword of Manjushri. Manjushri is one of the bodhisattvas in the pantheon of bodhisattvas within Buddhism, the bodhisattva of wisdom, often shown riding a lion, the greatest of beasts, considered a representation of wisdom. And typically in a Zen monastery, in the Zendo, in the sitting hall, there would be a Manjushri image on the altar. The Buddha would be in the Buddha hall where services were taking place, which is a separate hall. But we have a Buddha image here. So Manjushri often is sitting a lion and is often holding a sword. And this is the sword that cuts through delusion and that has two edges. One that is kills, often refers to as kills. And what that means is that it helps to dissolve, free us of all the things that we hold on to, of all of our false views. And so this sword cuts through all of those. And the other side of the sword, because once that has all been cut through, what's realized is the great emptiness, that the self is empty. There is nothing and no one that exists by itself, by themselves, independently, autonomously, separate. The other sword, side of the sword, is a life-giving sword. It brings us back to life into the world of people and things and situations and phenomena, so that we can be a benefit, so that we can live this wisdom and let it be a benefit to others. And so here in the pointer, he says, when the diamond sword cuts directly, I realize my hundredfold incompetence. So all summer, he says, he's been speaking to these koans, teaching, making up complications, almost entangling everyone. Because in a sense, when the Dharma is presented, even if it's clear and true and is pointing directly, by the very nature of it being language, it also creates certain complications because if the Dharma is presented as this, then the student thinks, oh, it's this, and fixates on that. And that becomes something. And if the teacher says, oh, it's this, then we fixate on that, and we forget about this. And it's that, and we fixate on that. And so that's why the teaching is constantly non-abiding. They don't land anywhere. They're not ambiguous. They're always presenting directly, but because language tends to narrow and in our minds solidify, the teachings have to constantly be not fixed so that our minds are not fixed. So this sword that cuts through all of delusions, the Buddha said all conditioned existence is dukkha, the first of the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha said, birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, sickness, dying, is dukkha. Distress, pain, anguish, affliction are all dukkha. Not getting what you want is dukkha. In short, the five aggregates, the skandhas, are dukkha. And this is a very profound teaching. Dukkha means suffering, and it means dissatisfaction and disappointment at the deepest level. And it said that there are three different aspects to dukkha. One is just ordinary dukkha, ordinary suffering, the suffering that everybody experiences by virtue of being born into this world, by virtue of having a physical body that gets ill, that gets bumped and cut and broken, but heals. That is, in difficult, if we find ourselves in difficult situations or with difficult people, we don't get what we want. We worry. We anguish over things. All of those are considered ordinary suffering, open to everyone. And then there's a suffering due to change. When something is good, we want it to be good forever, just like this. But everything is changing. Everything is in a state of unfolding. So in that sense, we are always living within a state of uncertainty. We don't know what's happening next. We plan on things. We expect to wake up tomorrow. We hope things will work out the way we want. But even if they do, they are still in a state of change. And that causes anxiety and distress. Status, position, relationships, possessions, all of it is in a state of change. And then the third aspect of dukkha is the most difficult to understand. It's that dukkha that arises due to conditioned state. Conditioned state, or composite, compounded state, means something that has come into existence not on its own. In other words, it's not self-generating, but it's a result of different influences, forces, factors that are all necessary for that one thing to come into being. And what the Buddha said is everything is like that. There's nothing that isn't like that. Everything is compounded. Everything is conditioned existence, conditional to those factors that are necessary for it to be. And so the sort of the most all-encompassing way the Buddha spoke of dukkha is by saying that the five aggregates are dukkha. Form, sensation, coming into contact with our senses with something and having a sensation, a feeling, and then we begin to perceive it. We understand it, we label it, we identify it, and then we like it or we don't like it. We want more of it or we want to get away from it. And our history, our views, our attachments, all of that floods in, and consciousness, the fifth skandha, is just awareness of all of this happening. The Buddha said, fundamentally, it's the aggregates, the skandhas, that are dukkha. Now, by saying they're dukkha, it doesn't mean, when the First Noble Truth says life is dukkha, it doesn't mean that dukkha is inherent in anything, because nothing has that quality. That's the whole thing, is that nothing exists in that way that has any quality or characteristic or existence that stands alone. But rather that all of this is subject to dukkha because of the way we use our minds, because of our false views, because of greed, anger, and delusion, because of our pride and jealousy, because of our thirsting for things. And it said that, and this was particularly important in the early years of Buddhism, to encounter the first teaching of the enlightened one to be life is suffering is like, well, that's kind of depressing. do I want to go further into this? But in Buddhism, it's not seen as being a pessimistic, it's not a value judgment. It's just stating the reality of things. And so it's not seen as pessimistic or obsessive or despairing. At the same time, the Buddhism is not unrealistically optimistic. It's not saying, don't worry, everything's fine, it'll all work out, right? Just keep your head down. Don't ask too many questions. It's not that either. It's based in reality. It's based in the understanding the dukkha is a universal human experience. It's something we all share together. It comes with human consciousness. And there's something we can do about it. We can gain freedom. We can bring forth our liberation because it has no fixed identity. It is not a thing. And the Buddha didn't deny that there was ordinary happiness. He recognized that, and he promoted that. You know, there are many sutras where he's talking to lay people, and he talks about, you know, money, for instance. You know, how much to save, how much to give away, how much to spend, how much to give to the family, so that they can buy nice things. The Buddha was, you know, recognized that there's many ordinary forms of happiness and all kinds of good things. But that when we're based, when we sort of are ensconced in this sense of a self and separateness, and then we look to those things in unrealistic ways to provide us with more, with deeper, more lasting forms of happiness or contentment, that they can't. They can't provide us with those things because they're dukkha. They're impermanent. And that the happiness that we seek is not in that thing. It's not in an object. It's not in a title or a job. It's not in another person that we might be in relationship with. But when we look to those things to give us that thing that we want, contentment, peace, fulfillment, rightly want, we will be disappointed. The Buddha said there is no success along that path because it's built into the path itself based on that view that we will experience dissatisfaction. And so Manjushri's sword is the image, the metaphor that cuts through, helps us to see through all of those false views and release all of those attachments. To be attached to things is delusion, we chanted this morning. Why? It's based on the idea that there is something, someone here, that is separate and distinct from something or someone there. And that my attachment to that thing, to try and draw it closer or to try and push it away if it's something negative, so that I can get that desired experience, is based on the illusion of the whole thing, the whole setup, is not being seen clearly. So the result is not going to be clear either. And so Manjushri's sword, the hair-blown sword, is that which cuts through all of that, frees us from all of that. Paling's response, what is the blown hair sword? That question, the footnote says, cut, dangerous. What is the danger? Maybe we should put a sign outside the front door, danger, beware of entry. Maybe not. The danger is, it is dangerous if, or to the degree, that we want to preserve and hold on to everything that we already have. Then it's dangerous. If we want to release, if we have lost our faith and just carrying on as before, then there will still be moments where we sense danger, but it's more release. It's more having discovered what we're seeking. And so Paling said, each branch of coral supports the moon, is the blown hair sword. What is he saying? And so this is a beautiful example of a characteristic teaching in Zen, where clearly he's not giving an explanation. He's not conveying information. He's presenting an image of something. Every branch of coral, just beneath the surface of the water, supports the moon, is holding the moon. What is that image? When you enter into that image, right, which you have to do, because it's not coming to you and giving you information or knowledge. It's not, that's not the purpose here. It's to disrupt. And the moon in Buddhism, and particularly in Zen, is a very strong image. The sun is often an image of radiance, of the bright radiance of clarity, of wisdom that illuminates everything. Everything is revealed and burns brightly in all directions. The moon, the exquisite, gentle moon, is often an image of enlightenment. And there's a fasco by Master Dogen, 13th century Zen master, on the moon, in which he quotes Shakyamuni Buddha, saying, "Buddha's true Dharma body, as it is open sky. In response to things, forms appear. Thus is the moon in the water." And since the beginning, nature has played a very important role, the earth and all of its many things, creatures, life forms, systems, has played a very essential role in Buddhist teaching. In the beginning years, the Buddha lived without any dwellings. There were no dwellings for the renunciates, so they lived out in the open all the time, wandering, practicing. The Zen tradition moved back into the mountains, often away from the cities, places that were quiet. And so the role of the mountains and rivers and sky and ocean and winds and all of these forces find their way into the teachings all the way since the beginning. And in a way, nature for human beings is probably our first spiritual teacher, right? As human beings for eons have studied and examined and been in awe and watched all of the creatures of nature interacting, the forces, and it found meaning, teachings. It made me think of Whitman's Song of the Rolling Earth. A song of the rolling earth and of words according. Were you thinking that those were the words, those upright lines, those curves, angles, dots? No, those are not the words. The substantial words are in the ground and sea. They are in the air. They are in you. The earth does not withhold. It is generous enough. The truths of the earth continually wait. They are not so concealed either. They are calm and subtle, untransmissible by print. They are imbued through all things, conveying themselves willingly. The earth does not argue. It is not pathetic. It has no arrangements. It doesn't scream, haste, persuade, threaten, promise. It makes no discriminations, has no conceivable failures, closes nothing, refuses nothing, shuts none out. Of all the powers, objects, states, it notifies, shuts none out. Our first teacher. So Dogen says, the Buddha's true Dharma body as it is open sky. The true Dharma body is the Dharmakaya, the body of reality, the body that was not given to you by your parents, that was not born in this lifetime and does not die. It is present in this form, in this human form. It is present in all things. This true Dharma body, the Buddha Dogen said, is open sky. And then in response to things, karmic causes, conditions, things appear. Like waves on the ocean. Like all of the creatures of the earth. And thus is the moon reflected in the water. Enlightenment appears within the bodies and minds of beings in the world. We all possess Buddha nature. That's what the Buddha realized. And so in that sense, we have nothing to gain. But until it's realized, it's another analogy or metaphor is it's like having a precious jewel in your coat pocket and not knowing it. And feeling impoverished all your life and not knowing that you have right there this great wealth. The image of the moon is expressing how enlightenment is always full, it's always complete, it's always generous in reflecting its light. Even when it appears, if you saw the moon this morning, it was exquisite. The subtlest of slivers as it ends its cycle. But it's whole. We may only see that sliver, but the moon is never anything but complete. Dogen says, the time when the moon appears is not necessarily night. Night is not necessarily dark. Don't be limited to the narrow views held by human beings. Even where there is no sun or moon, there is day and night. Sun and moon are not day and night. Each is as it is. And night is often referred to as the time when all sense of self drops away. It's in the night that the Dharma body, the body of reality, free of all characteristics of history, of worry, of dukkha, is realized. And just dropping away, which is why our meditation is so important, because our zazen is the time and the place, the vessel, the mind in which this dropping away, this entering into the night, is most easily available to us. But this dropping away is not something that we do, and that's a very hard thing for us to let go of, because we're so used to doing things. If you want to get somewhere, you have to do something to get there. If you want to get something, you have to do something to get that something. And here's the great effort of not doing, which is hard to trust. The habit is strong. And that's why we practice. Each branch of coral supports the moon. Every branch, every leaf of the tree, when the wind blows, stirs. Are they separate, or are they the tree? You can make out each branch and each leaf. You could count them if you wanted. To say that leaf is the tree, what about the remainder? To say that it's not the tree also seems wrong. Where's the error? What is tree? What is self? We chanted this morning, root and branch must return to the great reality. Each branch of coral supporting the moon returns to the great reality. And even that, because it's poetry, is compelling, and it speaks to us that that part of returning, a sense of returning, which seems to be a fairly universal sense of something, that we have somehow wandered away from something essential, from the source, and we need to find our way back. How many stories throughout the history of human beings tell that story? And it always begins at home, and then we wander away, and we always end up back home. Different. Not the same. And yet, not different. But to return to the great reality implies that we have somehow been apart from it. That is even possible, and that's what the Buddha realized. That's the essence of our delusion. That's what else would precipitate and make valid and sensible that whole sense of seeking outside of ourselves. But for the belief, the faith that there is something out there that is going to help something in here return somewhere. We call it home, or God, or reality. I've been rereading a book called The Tree by a biologist, Colin Tudge, who's a British biologist. And he's speaking as a biologist, he's speaking about trees, and he's sort of telling the story of how trees came to be, beginning with a single-celled organism in the soup millions of years ago. And he's talking about evolution. And so as you listen to this in terms of he's talking about trees and biology, but we are also organisms. We are also evolving, always. And so he says, Darwin suggested evolution was merely opportunistic, that each generation is essentially trying to solve its own problems as best as it can, and that as lineages of creatures unfold, and evolution literally means unfolding, that those creatures within that group might wander off in any direction as they try to solve the problem of their time and place. And so to think about how in every generation, each generation of people, us today, have been born into a time and place, a time of history, a time of the world, a time of humanity, a time of the earth, and each in our own place. And it's in that place that we evolve, that we interact with our environment, causes and conditions. And we try to work out the problems that we encounter as best we can. Because that's what living organisms do, right? That's our intelligence. It's brilliant. No wonder it's such a compelling story. And he goes on to say, one of the stunning and undeniable facts of evolution is the phenomenon of convergence, the way in which lineage after lineage of creatures, I couldn't find any evidence that he was Buddhist. He's clearly thinking both of biology, and I think he's thinking more largely, but it's just interesting the way he is presenting things. But he says that lineage after lineage of creatures have independently reinvented the sense, the same body forms, and often the same kind of behavior. He says there's no literal prescription for how life should turn out. But any two creatures in the same environment tend to evolve along much the same lines. And so he says all of these different, very different creatures living in water, because water poses its own particular problems, discovered that if they basically take the form of a fish, that works pretty well. Among plants, lineage after lineage has independently reinvented the form of the tree. A tree, after all, is a good thing to be. So he says, so nature may not be literally prescriptive. So for those of us in the Ango studying karma, remember what we've talked about in terms of, and what Trela Khyabgan talked about in terms of karma not being deterministic, prescriptive. But Colin Toge goes on to say, but it's not random either. It's not deterministic, but it's not just utterly open or, in a human context, subject to free will. Khyabgan said he had different language for it, but basically there's a middle path. We don't have utter free will because we have this human body and we're limited by that, and also we have consciousness, which is severely limited and constrained within delusion, by our ideas, our assumptions, our beliefs, our biases. But it's also not determined. We don't actually know what happens next. Not literally. But we have, once part of what we're doing is, as we live and mature and have experience, hopefully, is that we're learning from our experiences, right? That's something we can be pretty good at. And so when we commit a certain action, move in a certain direction, even though we can't literally know what happens next, we can have a pretty good idea. That if I am angry, and I act out of that anger, and I spill that anger onto everybody in my path, I don't know exactly how that's going to work out, but I can have a pretty good sense there's going to be problems. In the same way, if I am cultivating generosity and patience and kindness, I don't know exactly how that's going to play out in my life, but I can have some sense that it's going to be helpful and good. He says, living creatures are in perpetual dialogue with all that surrounds them. I think of that often in terms of evolution, you know, that we are creatures, you know, subject to causes and conditions. So we're acting, other creatures are acting, particularly human beings. And so in a sense, every action is like dropping a pebble in water, and our waves go out and they wash up on your shore. Meanwhile, you're acting, dropping pebbles into water, sometimes pebbles, sometimes rocks, sometimes boulders. And those respective waves wash up on my shore, sometimes they flood me, overwhelm me. Sometimes they drown. And so living creatures are in perpetual dialogue. So what are we evolving to now? So in the Buddhist time and for most of human history, and still for some people live so in and amidst the earth and all of its creatures. What are the creatures we evolved to? Computers, media, social media, governments, institutions. For many of us, that's our living environment. Those are the forces, the beings, the organisms that we are constantly interacting with, that we are in perpetual dialogue with because they surround us. And I often think of we're so good at creating things and so not good at understanding fully what we create. But it's just so fun to create stuff. And so we just do because we can, and then we put it out there and see what happens. And sometimes it's marvelous, and sometimes it's not. In perpetual dialogue with the other creatures that we encounter minute by minute, and with climate and landscape, which means we are all in perpetual dialogue with the whole world, which in turn is subject to the influence of the whole universe. Whatever other creatures may do, however the world changes, each individual must take everything else into account. Wendell Berry once said, the context of everything is everything. Avalokiteshvara realizes mind, all beings are of one essence. She opens the heart and nothing is forsaken. Everything is taken into account. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them, to liberate the suffering of all beings. Each of us, he says, is engaged in this dialogue with other creatures and with the universe at large from conception to grave. And yet, we can go through our whole lives and largely not know that we are in dialogue. I mean, think about that. It's like usually when we're talking to someone, we have some awareness that we are talking to someone. But think about the fact that we're in perpetual dialogue in all kinds of ways, through all of our senses, with all other creatures, and we don't know. What are we saying? What are we communicating? And not knowing that we are in dialogue with other creatures, we don't know that other creatures are in dialogue with us. What are they saying? What is not being heard? So Dongshad said, you have to hear with your whole body and mind, not just with your ears. We have to see with the whole body and mind, not just with the eyes. And that's why in Zazen and meditation and Buddhist practice, we have to bring forth that body of the Buddha, that reality body, because otherwise we are so embedded within our senses, which are adept at perceiving signals within their range. But their range is other objects. And in that, it's like, you know, it's like when you see a dog, you're walking down the street, and you know, maybe you smell some flowers, and you see a dog, and their nose is working. And it's like, what are they smelling? You know, or when they go up and like stick their nose into a rotting corpse, and it's like, you know, cordon bleu. It's like blue cheese. It's like, you know, it's like a banquet. So we see signs of this. It's like, okay, there's communication going on. I'm not getting it. And isn't that why the Buddha almost didn't teach? He said, because this dharma is so subtle and so profound, what he was really saying, I think, is that this world is so subtle and profound. Living creatures, our relationships, our interactions, all of this, these systems within systems, these worlds within worlds, are so profound. They cannot be understood simply through our senses. They can't. And so Buddhist practice is helping us to sharpen those senses by calming the mind, and so they become very alive, very alert. And so through those senses, we are actually able to perceive the world that is in front of us and is perceivable and is alive. And it's exquisite. But it also helps us to go further beyond what we can experience through our senses, which means the senses have to rest. Calming means resting. And that's, in a sense, a progression. They can be very agitated, very distracted, working way too hard in ways that are not helpful and exhausting. But as they calm, we begin to experience things more and more brightly, more clearly. The world becomes more and more alive, more intimate. And then when they cease, fully at rest, then that aspect of the mind, which is in perpetual dialogue, because it's basically talking to itself. It's not talking to the many creatures. It's one mind. It's one body. So he goes on to say, what applies to individuals also applies to whole lineages of creatures. As they evolve over time, whole lineages of living creatures, whether of oaks or dogs or human beings, are engaged in this dialogue from inception to extinction. All creatures might in principle be able to evolve in an infinite number of ways, as Darwin suggested, but if they are to survive along the way, then they each must solve their particular problems of their own environment at all times, and to each problem there is a limited number of solutions. I don't know whether that's true. I don't know if that's an important thing to worry about. But I think what is true and is easier to be clear about is that the solutions that may be available to us, some of them will actually be solutions and some of them will not. Some of them will pretend to be. They will partly solve the problem. It's sort of like paint. You know, paint hides all wounds on the wall. Unless the wound is too deep. Right? Then you have to apply something heavier, thicker. Kind of what we do. But it doesn't really repair. It doesn't really heal. And so that's why the emphasis in Buddhism on skillfulness. What is truly liberating? What practices are those that have been seen, not just once, not just by the Buddha? I mean, think about it. What if the Buddha, you know, practiced meditation, came to this great enlightenment, taught meditation, and it didn't work for anybody else? Just imagine, right? We wouldn't be here, right? It would not be skillful. It would not be universal. The reason we are here is because what he realized and what he taught is universal for anyone who steps forward. And of course, for that, there has to be causes and conditions, a big part of which is our own inner workings, our affinity, our trust, our sense that this is true. I don't know why it's true. I can't explain that or justify it, but I know that this is true, this Dharma. Right? None of us know that this is true in the beginning when we first begin sitting. We don't actually know. We don't actually know that attachments are truly binding us. We don't know that the self is empty. We don't know that having a sense of self creates suffering. There's so much that we don't know. And yet, somehow, almost inexplicably, there's the sense that in the presence of all that I don't know, all of my ignorance, there is a sense, a conviction, a confidence that there is, I have encountered something that's true. Is that a moment of that perpetual dialogue being heard? I think so. And the beauty, the wonder, is that we listen. That we listen and trust and step forward. When it is necessary to even the uneven, the poem, to heal the wounds, to bring together the divisions, to hush the baby's cry, to bring back to life from the dead. Even the great adept seems inept. Even all of these teachings, even all of these practices, can it sometimes seem very awkward and clumsy because from the beginning, nothing is divided, nothing is broken. Each branch of coral supports the moon. The moon is always full. The earth is always in complete harmony with itself. We ourselves, too, are like that. But the power of our mind is such that we can create what Buddhism describes as illusions, like a magic show, that convince us that the world is otherwise. And so this great light, this moon's radiance, sitting in the branch of every coral, in perpetual dialogue, deep understanding. Sometimes it's on the finger, sometimes it's in your palm, sometimes it's in your heart. Sometimes you seem to not be able to find it. Leaning against the sky, it shines on the snow. But even a great smith couldn't hone it, even a master craftsman will never finish polishing it. Exceptional, unique, each branch of coral supports the moon. You know, that's why the idea of self-transformation is, in Buddhism, a false view, a sort of misperception, as though there is this thing, it's just not quite right, but with a little here and a little there, we'll make it perfect, we'll bring it around, we'll transform it into something. And the Buddha really laid that to rest. He said, no, that's never going to work. That's why we all have the experience of no matter what we do, it's never quite enough. No matter how much we have, no matter how much we are, no matter how much we accumulate. From the beginning, it's never been anywhere else. And so I encourage those of you, all of you, all of us, but particularly those of you who are here for the weekend too. And I feel it was a very sincere group of people. You know, sometimes people come to these retreats and, you know, aren't really clear about, you know, what they're seeking and about the Buddhist path. And that's what it's for. That's what the retreat is for, is to help bring some clarity to that. But it felt like there was a lot of sincerity, even among some of you who were just starting, you know, who had barely begun a meditation practice. And so I just encourage you to respect that sincerity, to feed it, to nurture it, and to continue to examine and develop and find a true path worthy of your efforts. This dialogue that this biologist speaks of, how could it be that as a biologist studying plants and trees and the laws of nature would see, speaking in a different language, using different tools, and conceptually, but would speak in a way that we can so clearly understand from the point of view of Dharma? Because it's true. So, there, to borrow the words of an old Buddha, so there.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.